Well, sometimes you have to pay the price. The point of the series has been, is anybody here for the first time? They've liked it so far. That's all I can do.
He really came in to rest.
Okay.
Continue right on.
Okay. Okay. All right. The point of the series has been that geology is an observational science rather than a calculation science or whatever you call mathematics or an experimental science, which I think chemistry and physics are. To do geology, you go out and look at the rocks and the landforms and the relationship between the rocks, and then you make some hypotheses or figure out what's implied based on the things that you've seen. A quick review of yesterday, since that's the first thing on our list of things to do. Yesterday we talked about basic geological concepts, or basic, what I call the laws of geology. The first one of those is the law of original horizontality. The theory there is that all rocks were laid down flat when they were initially laid down. This really applies to 75 or 80% of the rocks. Volcanic rocks that come off the sides of a volcano get laid down at an angle, but in most cases the rocks get laid down flat. And therefore, if you find rocks and they're not flat, you have to think of some reason that they got tipped up to the angle that they got tipped up to. The second law is the law of superposition, which is that if you have a stack of rocks, the oldest rocks are on the bottom. And as the layers go up elevationally, the rocks get younger. The converse of that would be somehow you slid older rocks under newer rocks, or newer rocks under older rocks, sort of like shuffling cards back into a deck, and that's hard to do out in the physical world. We talked a little bit, and people who have handouts from yesterday have some indications as to the way that you can determine that the beds are in their original position. A couple of the ways that we looked at that, where we talked about this idea of graded bedding, that if you see a rock layer that you think to be sedimentary rock laid down by a stream, and you see different packets of rock that you can identify as being separate by some boundary, graded bedding indicates that the heaviest rocks will be at the bottom, or the biggest rocks will be at the bottom. You can't tell they're heavy by looking at them. The biggest rocks will be, or biggest grains will be at the bottom, and the grains will get smaller as you go towards the top of the unit. That indicates that this unit is in place. We talked about that being important because in some places beds get overturned, and so that if you come across a series of beds, that are at an angle, there's two ways that those beds could have gotten to that angle. One is there was something on this side that pushed them up to that angle. The other thing is there's something that's pushed them up from this side that has pushed them over the vertical, and those are called overturned beds. And for those people who think that that may be rare geologically, this entire section of rocks that makes up most of the valley here is simply that, overturned beds. They have been pushed up over the vertical. So that if you saw that same situation, you would see the rocks, you would see the grains appearing to fine. If you were walking up Honeymoon Heights, you would come across them this way, and you'd say, wait a minute, the rocks are getting bigger as you go towards the base of the unit. That must mean that these beds are overturned. The other way that we looked at that was if you find in a series of different units these little channels, or these little cut channels is what I call them. I don't know what they're called in the text that we passed out. That indicates that this unit is also, this series, this sequence is in place. The opposite of that would be something where you've got to generate these humps sticking out of the unit, and that's hard to do. If you get a hump sticking out of the unit, erosion will take care of that fairly rapidly. Okay. Yes, sir.
Those striations in the copper vein up there, that mountain, those are, that's all overturned then?
Yes, sir.
All those striations that come through there, various levels? And at one time, the copper load or whatever it was on top, as opposed to being curled back now? Okay.
Actually, the copper, my understanding is that the copper is at the, it's at the stratigraphic base. It doesn't work very well. When this was laid down, it was laid down at the base of the unit. And now, when we see it in place up there on the hill, it's actually at the top of the unit, as you're elevationally. So, it was laid down at the bottom, but now, since it's been overturned, it appears to be at the top. The law of inclusions, we talked about, if you find a rock that has a fracture in it, and then that fracture has been filled in, here's your rock mass. There's a fracture in it. And that fracture has been filled in with some other kind of material, and we'll see a lot of this tomorrow on the hike. What you will normally find is, if this rock is designated by these X's, that these inclusions indicate that the material in the crack is younger than the material being included. Inclusions are older than the material they're included in. The only other way that you can think of this happening is if somehow you had some flat-lined layer here, you jammed stuff underneath it, put the same stuff on top of it, and somehow got some of it into the unit, and that's hard to do. Law of cross-cutting relationships. We talked about if we have a blue marker line as being a geologic event, let's some sort of something coming in along a fracture, and then at some later point, some other kind of material coming in along another fracture. What you will find is that the younger event cuts the older event. So that if I had another layer of tape on there, if that wasn't thick enough to, or if that was thick enough to not see through, you would see that blue line being broken by the tape line. And then, if at some point in the future after that there was a fault, it would offset both of the older events, this vein set and this vein set, and therefore younger events offset older events, so that if you're out doing field work and you see things that get offset, you can start to develop a pattern of what the old events are and what the young events are, and therefore build up a geologic history of the area. The last thing we talked after that, we talked about that relative age dating, which was the process of trying to use different things the way they lie, superposition, oldest rocks on the bottom, youngest on the top, cross-cutting relationships, to develop a geologic history. And we did some block diagrams that were very straightforward, but it's the same process the geologists use to figure out the geology of an area. The last thing we talked about was this idea of an unconformity. And Kathleen, if you'll put up, we'll look at a couple of overheads. The first one is,
this one?
Yes.
Focus. Oh, yeah. Okay.
All right, if you could turn that over.
Upside down. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay.
And it's too dark to see, so let's not worry about it. Get rid of it.
Turn off the lights.
Nah, don't worry about it. It's no big deal.
Next
one. I'm thinking we'll be able to see. We talked about how an unconformity is developed. And a series of events that takes place. A series of sedimentary layers get laid down and they get laid down flat. Law of original horizontality. folded during mountain building. If you push on a series of layers from the sides, they will buckle. Take a piece of carpet and do that, or take a phone book and push it on the sides, and it'll form into a hump or a trough, one of the two. Once you have these areas of higher elevation, erosion starts to work on them, and you erode it back down to a flat surface. And then the fourth thing that happens is more sediment gets laid down on that surface, so that you can see in places you will see a surface of erosion, and the rocks underneath it will look different in orientation than the rocks from above it. And if you'll throw up the next slide, this is the angular unconformity at Sicker Point in Scotland that James Hutton came across in 1788. And he saw this series of essentially vertical rock layers, an erosion surface, another series of rock layers that were not horizontal, and he developed some of the basic concepts of geology by looking at that, and those were the ideas that were in that previous slide we just looked at, was that he saw the nearby bays and streams dumping out into the bays, lying rocks down flat. And so he said, well, wait a minute, these have to get laid down flat, they have to get tipped up on end. This thing represents some surface of erosion. More rocks got laid down on top of that, and the whole package got tipped again. And his thinking was, you got to be around for a long time to have things like that happen. And the last thing that I left you with was, if you're trying to figure out the time here, it may be that more of the time is shown or is represented by the break by that unconformity than is shown by the amount of deposition that took place. That segues very nicely into a commercial. So you can turn that off for right now, Kathleen. This is Kathleen, by the way. Besides being one of the registrars, she's an excellent projectionist for geologic talks. All right, I want to do two quick commercials. I haven't done any all week. The first one is for the company I work for called Dames & Moore. At the first of the year, we were supposed to put in our vacation requests, and I put in my vacation request for these 2 weeks because I knew I was going to be up here, and in the cover letter I sent to my boss, I said, you know, if you wanted to, you could support some of my time while I'm at Holden Village, and on those days, if you decide to do that on those days, I will speak even more fondly of the company than I normally do. And so she laughed too, which is good. And then of the 10 days I am up here, Dames & Moore is supporting me for 3 of those days. And since it's Friday, the last of the sessions, and the tape has already started, there's really no chance that my boss is ever going to hear this. So it's not like I'm trying to suck up to him or anything. I'll do that with the directors at Holden Village, but I won't do it with my boss at work. So. The thing is, I've been working for Dames & Moore for 10 years, and this is the first boss that I have had who would see this as being a reasonable use of my time. So I think that's neat, and he's a good guy, even if the company's a little messed up. So that's my Dames & Moore commercial. My other commercial is for books. Last week when I was talking, I said I would try and tell people about books that I thought were particularly good at the point of taking geologic concepts and explaining those to people who are interested but don't have a real technical background. The book I talked about a lot last week is a book called Naked Earth by a woman named Shauna Vogel. And based on my recommendation, Aaron Barnes from the village here has read this, says it's an excellent book, highly recommends it. If you see him, you can ask him and he'll tell you the same thing. I'm not making that up. It explains geophysics, which is on the one hand, a really dry, really, really dry subject, and makes it kind of cool. The other stuff, if you want to read some geology, there's an author named John McPhee who wrote for The New Yorker for a long time and has written 25 or 30 books. I've read probably 10 of them. They're excellent on all topics. Of someone who writes explanatory prose, I don't know anybody that does it better than John McPhee. And he's got like four books on geology. He's written another one. I'm mad because he's put them all in a compendium, and the only way you can get the fifth book is to buy all five of them.
Yeah.
So we'll have words next time we talk.
Hey, Don.
Yes.
The his book, Something About the Arch Druid, the first whole third is at Lima Lake.
Right. And one of his earliest book is called Encounters with the Arch Druid, and the protagonist of that is David Brower, who was the first president of the Sierra Club. And what McPhee did was bring David Brower together with three guys who were really going to be on the opposite side of the table. So David Brower wants to save the forests, and he had to hike up through here and go up to Lyman Lake with a mining geologist who was out looking for new places to dig copper. And it's an interesting book, and it's very well explained. So John McPhee, any of his books are good. The ones on geology I like particularly well. And this idea of the unconformity that we just talked about. This is the first geology book he wrote. It's called In Suspect Terrain. The woman who is the protagonist of this book is not all that convinced about plate tectonics or thinks it's kind of over-applied. They're talking about back in the Appalachians, and on one page she says, 12,000 feet of this black mud was deposited in 12 million years. So somewhere back east, there is a 12,000 foot thick layer of shale, section of shale, and it took 12 million years to get deposited. And then a couple of pages later, they are talking about an unconformity, and the Martinsburg is soft, that's the shale layer that they talked about before, and is therefore valley. There is nothing but time between the two. Where the formations meet, a touch of a finger will cover both the beginning and the end of the 10 million years, which are dated at about 440 and 430 million years before present. So there are two layers that meet at some place. And this is an erosion surface, an unconformity. And the 12 million years before that is represented by 12,000 feet of rock. And then 10 million years is represented by a thickness of a pencil and whatever that space is between the two. So when you see a big pile of rock like you do down at the Grand Canyon, the greatest expanse of geologic time is in the little erosional surface that you see between the layers that are all tipped up on end and the layers that are laid down flat.
Would you write those numbers beside the little line there? I can't hear the numbers. You're saying that the erosion surface represents a greater span of time.
Almost equivalent to the 12,000 feet of rock. This stuff has been dated at 440 million years ago, and this stuff has been dated at 430 million years ago. So there's a 10 million year gap. 10 million years of geologic time is represented by the piece of paper you can slide in there, and the 12 million years before that is represented by 12,000 feet of rock. Okay. So we're done with the commercials. It's on to pictures and arm waving, which is really my favorite part.
Vaudeville?
Sorry?
Vaudeville?
No, arm waving geology. That's sort of a loose term for, if you want to pass those upstairs, though.
Sure.
You can just throw them up there. Somebody will reach down. All right, there are 20 packs of these that are complete, so I'm hoping should be about perfect. Arm waving geology is geology at its greatest what's the opposite of detail? Generality. If you're gonna talk real specific geology, you got to do it with a microscope and figures, and you do tests and stuff like that. But arm waving geology is the stuff that you can do as you're out walking around tomorrow on the trail and looking down at stuff. So, Kathleen, if you will fire up the lights, and there's about five or six in there that we're not going to use.
You want this first one?
The first one. should look something like the first one you all have.
Is that right?
It's good. Flip it over. All right. This is a road cut. As I was driving out I-84 coming from Portland to Wenatchee last Saturday, whatever day it was, Friday afternoon, and stopped by and took a look at this road cut and took a photo of it. And what I see here, actually, Kathleen, it's the other way.
No.
Really?
No.
Okay, fine. Just turn it the way you want. Perfect. Okay, that earthquake. Okay. And so what I've tried to do is pick out photos that I've taken over my time doing geology and that I hope are somehow illuminative or illustrative, and point out the things I see, and if you see something different, shout it out, because I don't know all the geology that's out there. When one of these other rules that we've talked about applies, I will try to point it out. If you see something, pass that along. There's a bottom unit here, and the contact maybe somewhere up here, something like this. In this lower unit, what I see is you got boulders in there. I don't know, that's a bowling ball size piece of rock. So that in this bottom unit, you have everything from silt particles, you know, fine grained particles, up through, you know, thumbnail size particles, up through golf balls, up through baseballs, up through softballs, and up to bowling balls. Now, when we talked on Wednesday about rocks and the variation in grain size, right? We talked about once something got out into the environment and spent a long time there, it got into the rock tumbler and showed some of this sand that is beach sand, and since it's been sitting on the beach for a million years, it's all the same size. And what I pointed out at that point was if you get this great variety of grain sizes, you have to invoke something pretty powerful. If it's a small stream, it's not moving these rocks. The rocks are too big for the stream to move. So it's either something big, and if it's a big stream, this fine grain stuff shouldn't be here. It should be down the road somewhere. To me, this indicates that this thing sort of came down in something pretty viscous, like a mud flow. That's my guess for what this is, that this is some sort of mud flow that came down kind of in a pasty form with water in it and the fine grain material making the paste, and that stuff being viscous enough, being thick enough that it could move and support the bigger bowling ball sized rocks that you find in there.
What would be different if it were glacial, if taken down by a glacier? Would it be more stratified?
If it were glacial, my suspicion would be that you'd find even a bigger range of particle sizes in there. I mean, the biggest thing that I see in there is bowling ball size. Uh-huh. A glacier will pick up stuff that's bus size. So that, and this being in Oregon, this being a basalt layer above it, I assume that to be the case, and finding one down below it, that, I mean, there, it's not, you know, whatever you see in the field has to come used with whatever experience you have of the area and what you know about the geology of the area as well. So that's my guess here, but I think also if you find glacial material, the range of particle sizes you can find would be even bigger.
Yeah, okay, good.
I think this may be a fault right here. Mm-hmm. I see it pretty clearly up in this portion of the picture, and I'm not sure whether I'm imagining it down here or whether it actually extends through there. If that's the case, I think it offsets this contact. It has to be younger than the contact. And therefore, the lava flow gets deposited geologically very quickly, right? Lava flow flows out over the ground, and it's not like a portion of this lava flow is going to be faulted and the other part not. So, anybody see anything else or think I'm nutty about that?
No,
we'll go with what I say. If you would slide that up.
Can you say something about superposition? Is there any observation you can make about that?
That the lava flow is younger than the mud flow, being on top of it. This is a little further along the drive, and on your picture it probably shows up better that these columns are just spot on vertical, and there's about a million of them out there, and they line up right next to each other, and it's a real stunning thing when you see it. Now, I can't explain very well, this is when Peter was in class on Monday, his question was, are these things big crystals? No, they're not. It's when the basalt cools, this is out of a rock that's called basalt, which is a real low viscosity volcanic magmatic rock, so it flows a long way horizontally. When the basalt cools, it has to do with, that's the most geometrically favorable, I guess, way, if you cool around certain centers, a hexagonal pattern is the most efficient way to break up or for the rock to cool into solid units, which is what happens. So that if one of these falls down and you pick it up by the side of the road, it's hexagonal in cross-section, six-sided. These things lay, or when you see them, if you would stand up on top here and could get a flat look down on the base or at the top of them, you would see that they form these hexagonal units and they fit together really tightly. And I've drawn all I can without messing up, so.
It's like a beehive.
Yeah, exactly. It's like beehive. Now, if you'll flip to the next slide and show the top part of that, I think. Well, both parts of this. Good.
Upside down.
Okay. I don't know basalt very well because I just moved to Oregon. But my understanding of, from the people who study them a lot, is there's sort of two parts to a basalt flow. This is the top of the flow, and this is schematic. This is not always the case. The top and the bottom part are that real columnar stuff. And in the middle is what they call entablature, which I don't know why you need to know it, but next time you're on Jeopardy, it will help.
A-T-U-R-E.
Okay. I don't think they care about spelling on Jeopardy. Okay. They have this. That's all right. She's just trying to help me get it right. I appreciate that. You have this columnar stuff on top, columnar stuff on bottom, and then this entablature in the middle, which is, from looking at the two slides that you have, this stuff goes every bloody way there is in the world. You got stuff here going this way, and stuff coming out at you, and stuff going this way, and stuff going this way. And I haven't read in a book why this happens. So I have a hypothesis. I have a really good idea. I think it's right. What if this thing flows out, the air is cool, and the rock below it is cool, right? And so the top and the bottom of this flow are the things that are going to cool first. And they cool into these hexagonal patterns in the columns. And then I think what happens is this is two pieces of bread, and this is the jelly in the middle of the sandwich. You've got two rigid pieces, and in between you still have something that's soft, and the rigid piece on top's pretty heavy. And so that stuff in the middle is leaking out the edges every place it can and flowing in these strange ways until it solidifies. That's my peanut butter and jelly sandwich theory for how basalts form. And since there's no other books in here in the village about basalts, that's what we're going with. But I think it makes sense. Anybody got a better idea? Okay. Next slide, please. That same, this is another piece of the same road cut that this came out of. This is on I-84, like Cascade Locks area of Oregon. And if you drive by it, I mean, it's the most classic piece of entablature basalt that I've seen in my, I've been here a year now, and I've driven the gorge a bunch of times and been down to Bend. And this, when you drive by it, it's half a mile long, and if you were to try and take orientations, if you're trying to measure which way things were there, you'd be all over the compass. Whereas if you were looking at that columnar part, you just have column after column after column. So that's the.
Is this all along I-84?
So far, everything that I've shown, that Kathleen's shown. This is at mile 76 along the Columbia. And again, it's easier to see in your picture, so just sort of follow along. This is west going this way towards me. There's a whole bunch of parallel layers that I assume are separate basalt flows. And you get to a point, and there's a big horseshoe right about here. And then maybe you pick up things a little differently again on the far side of it. And the first time I drove by that, I thought, okay, and these layers that extend west extend for a couple of miles anyway. As you're driving along, you can follow them along, and then something happens. And I thought, well, there's got to be a big fault there. As it turns out, I've done a little bit of reading, and this is an anticline, which is one of those folds. When you have your piece of carpet and you push it, and it part of it goes up and part of it goes down. Geologists call this curved up thing anticline, and the way I remember it is that this looks like a letter A. And so this is a real, and the handouts that I gave you yesterday, the last few pages started to talk about folds, because it's a big thing in geology and we just haven't had a lot of time to talk about it. If you read that, you'll read that this upturned hill or upturned set of beds is called an anticline. The one that is a trough is called a syncline. And you can remember that this is a syncline because it's not the one that looks like an A, which is an anticline. So by default, it's a syncline. So evidently, there's a pretty major major anticline in here, which is sort of an upturned thing. I assume that means that there's compression. The way that you get this sort of formation, I mean, if you take a carpet and pull on it, you don't get waves in it, right? You got to push on it. You got to push on the sides. And so there's something that was compressing this unit and trying to shorten it, and therefore this hump formed in the middle of it. And I don't know how I still think there has to be a fault in there somewhere, because you don't get that by pushing on a piece of carpet. And until I would go up and look at that, until we all went up there and looked at that and said, wait a minute, if what this really does is this, then maybe there's an anticline there, but you got to figure the mechanics of doing that is harder for me to get than there being a fault in there or some other structure. But that's on the other side of the river, and I haven't looked at it closely, and geologists have mapped it and called it an anticline, so I'm going with them.
Is it possible to have an anticline and not a syncline then?
More, I think what you find is something that goes like this. That's called a monocline, mono for one. But to have a, like that, essentially is what you're talking about. Yeah, I guess I think that then I would start to think that there was something right in this area that was really weak, and that these two pieces were rigid and just sort of popped up that right, bubble, or pop, you know, same opposite thing like that. But that's...
So, but it's still called an anticline whether you have the syncline associated with it or not?
Yes. Yep. It's the form itself. Mm-hmm. If you push that overhead up a little bit, the other thing that I wanted to point out from this that is you can do geology a lot of different ways, or you can do a lot of geology without ever looking at the rocks. You can do geology by looking at the trees that are on the rocks, or you can do geology by looking at the other things that grow on it. And it seems to me that a lot of things here change just besides this layering that I talked about in the rock. On the east side of the fold of the anticline, it seems to me that the landforms are way more rounded. Here you've got a set of stair steps going up the hill, and here all of a sudden everything is all rounded and smoothed off. The other thing is the vegetation changes. On one side you have these stair steps, and on top you have sets of pine trees, I guess they are. I don't know trees very well, but stuff laying on top of it. And over here you've got grassland or scrubland or weedland. So geology is not just about the rocks. It's the stuff that grows on it. It's the shape of the landforms. That's another way that it's a very observational science, and it's frankly not one of the things I'm all that good at. So I need all the help I can get. If you see anything in here that I haven't mentioned, shout it out. All right. Next over. This is a picture of a wall made out of rock. This is in Sydney, Australia, in the area called the Rocks, which is the area where when the convicts were first taken to Australia, this is the part of Sydney that they were dumped on. And there's a little creek where the main ferry terminal is now, and on one side of it was where the nice people lived, and on the other side is where the ex-cons lived, and then their families as they finished their terms in prison and were released back into society. They couldn't cross the river. That's not a geology story, but... And these are, first off, there's a series of relatively parallel layers that are at a slight angle, and then there is a clear break here to my way of looking at it, and then a series of essentially horizontal layers that vary. There's a little changes in thickness. There's a little some places where you see some waviness to them. And above and below was still too it wasn't clear enough for me to be able to pick anything out from it. My thinking is that this sub-horizontal stuff down at the bottom might have actually been sand dunes. If you take sand that's been moved by air, it will tend to stack up sometimes more steeply than this, but occasionally on a very low angle. I think those represent sand dunes. This, to me, is some section that indicates near shore deposition into shallow water. The material here is, I don't ever put scale into my photos, which is a bad thing, but I mean, this is probably 10 feet across, so this packet is 2 feet high, so each of these layers is an inch thick. And the grains in that are small grains. So I assume that this stuff is something that was dumped out into a shallow bay in the quiet water. Now, how do we have sand dunes at one point in our geologic history and then get stuff dumped on top of it that we think comes out of water? Last week when we talked about our plate tectonics, one of the things that we pointed out is that water levels rise and fall over geologic time. I don't know what the greatest extent of water level rise and fall has been, but it's in the hundreds of feet. So that there are times that you can have things that are above ground that due to tectonic forces, the forces that move the earth, if that water, if you build more mountains under the ocean, you jack up the water level, and what used to be ground, what used to be a beach, what used to be dunes sitting behind the beach, now over the next 10 million years, those get buried, and now what used to be the dunes behind the beach is the shoreline. And then it's a little bit below the shoreline, and a creek that comes out will dump stuff into a small bay or a real quiet water bay. And again, that's my interpretation of what the geology is that's represented here is. So that if we could take a sample of these two units and get them age dated, or if we found some volcanic rock that had come in on a fracture and had intruded it, we could get an age date on this and start to make some time-specific geologic story of Sydney, Australia. Right now, I have two things that are somewhere in time, and I have no idea whether they are 30 million years ago or 500 million.
Question, and in my summit ignorance, I think sand dunes, I think sand, small grainy stuff. I think stuff coming down the creek, small grainy stuff.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. How do you know it wasn't the lower one? How would one decide whether the lower one was really a different layer of underwater sand or silt or whether it was a dune type of thing?
Well, I think his hypothesis could be that instead of these being sub-horizontal, they were actually laid down horizontally, and that bit of package has been twisted a little bit, and then he wrote it flat. Right? That's certainly that's an alternative hypothesis, and I'm trying to think about how you would do that if you could see enough of this to find another set of dunes, another set of these lines that would represent the backside of the dune, and they would drop off like that, then I think you could pretty well convince yourself it's a dune sand.
Yeah, what I was wondering is, I think, for good or for ill, is the sand and dunes, what dunes I have seen, it's a little bit greedy, a little bit grainier, and stuff that comes down the river has more of a siltier, finer.
There's that
part to it.
That, I mean, that's if you find that mixed with finer grain material, then that's probably a better indication it's creek stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So I don't know. We could head down there. And
what's the brown stuff on the bottom?
This. That's the ground. That's the.
It's the technical term. Yeah.
It's the. It's the dirt of the, you know, the wall starts right here, right? It's just
the wall starts right here.
Yeah. Yeah, this is shooting from across the street. That's the grass or dry grass.
Oh, I see.
Okay. Next slide. All right. This is in Melbourne, Australia. Beach, as you can tell. And some sort of sedimentary rock, I think, because there are layers in it that I can see but don't track real well. I also think that there is probably some sort of carbonate material, carbon-containing material, limestone-like material. Limestone is a kind of rock, and the chemical formula of that is calcium carbonate, and it weathers in a very distinctive pattern like this, that the rainfall falls on carbonate rock and dissolves it essentially, and so you get these real I don't know what the real term for that texture is, but these fragments in here, the edges can get real sharp. And so, again, I think some sort of the layering indicates that it's sedimentary. I assume that these are sandier layers. I assume that these are more carbonate layers, and that indicates that shore. Carbonate comes primarily from the skeletons of microorganisms. And so this indicates to me that this rock, if it's in place, at some points the water level was shallower, and therefore this is sand coming off the world behind us, and then in some places it got deeper, so that we now went out further away from the beach, and it's these microorganism skeletons that are sort of raining down as the things die and stacking up and making this more carbonate rock. Again, I haven't studied the geology of Melbourne, so I don't know much about it, but that's my hypothesis. Next one. All right, Joanne.
What?
Oh. What's the range of grain sizes here?
Big and little.
From really, really little to really, really, really big.
Oh, that's great.
This is a photo of a road cut, and you have another one that's at the top of your next page that's kind of taken around the corner here. And if you look in the wall, or if you go to the Eagle Mine in Minturn, Colorado, and hop the fence and go look at this, there are silt-sized particles in this unit. And there is a rock here that, if it fell on you, would kill you. So, big change in grain sizes. As Joanne was saying before, and I talked about a little bit, how do you get from very, very fine grain sizes to the largest grain sizes imaginable? And in this case, it's the fluid has a lot of viscosity to it. The fluid is water, but it's frozen, so it's ice. And this boulder may have fallen onto the glacier somewhere up the road, up the valley, and been transported, and at some point melted into the glacier, and then got jammed against something with fine grain material around it. So when you see a range of grain sizes from silt size to VW bug size, the only way that I think that you, the only way I know of that you can get that is in glacial material. The other thing about this is when you look at the predominance, it's predominantly fine grain stuff, right? I think if we would throw up that first one we looked at, don't do it, but if you go back and look at it, there's a fair amount of that is made up of cobbles and rocks and golf ball size stuff and bowling ball size stuff. In this case, I think there's less of that in here. Most of it's fine grain, but at the same time, you've got these big things in there that you say, how do you ever transport all of that stuff at the same time?
And they're more angular, although not real angular. So it's not a stream here thing that's been tumbled.
Yeah, and if for some reason, as this was being carried along in the ice, it rubbed up against the sidewall of the valley, like here, you can get something that may be rounded on one side and dead flat on the other side, and that's another giveaway. The only way that you can do that is to hold that rock in place and scrape it along. The other thing you'll find is in the valley wall, you'll find the scrape mark that matches up to it. So that's another, if you're looking in a glacial area like this, if you come across hard rock in the valley walls, you may see those striations as something has been dragged across it. So, anybody see anything else in that one? Starting to get a little soil development on here. The other thing that you'll find about these moraine deposits or glacially moved deposits, if you can get an angle to look down on them from above, the deposits will have a real arcuate shape. And what happens is the glacier is coming down this way, and the last one that you see is called the terminal moraine. This indicates that at some point the glacier, the form of the glacier was that. We go back up into the valley here, and the glacier got this far and then melts off. At the end of it, the temperature over the long period of time is such that it can't get any further and stays right there. And all of the stuff that gets transported by the glacier gets sort of dumped out in one spot. The other place that you find this material, it's called a moraine, is along the valley walls. And what you'll find along the valley walls is it's really compacted, it's really smashed, and it's really tight, and it's really dense. And that's what you'll find here. The first 50 feet of the portal at Holden Mine is dug in through glacial moraine material, but as the glacier was coming down the valley at us, just sort of mashed that stuff up against the sidewall. And so it's in there, and it's in there firm. And so if at some point they decide they're gonna do something to make a new diversion trench around the back of the tailing piles, they're gonna be digging in real dense glacial till. Because you don't find it, this material isn't nearly as dense because there hasn't been anything mashing on something. It's just sort of been, pooped out at the end of the glacier. So that's glacial till. And that's another picture right around the other photo was sort of taken this way. And here's another piece of rock that's half a refrigerator size laying on the ground there. And when you hike on these things, or one of the ways that you come across them is this is one of those places where you'll be out hiking in the world and you'll come across this, you'll walk up on top of a hill and then come back down the other side and go, wait a minute, what happened there? And that's the cross section of this moraine. And so this is at a mine site that I worked at quite a bit, and every now and again you'd be walking along and all of a sudden you kind of go up in elevation, go, and you look down and you go, yeah, here's a little grain size, and over there's a big, a big thing. We're back on the moraine. So that's another picture of the moraine. All right. This is an angular unconformity, I think. The other hypothesis is that these are more sand dunes. That and in this case, if we go with the sand dune hypothesis, the sand is blowing, or the wind is blowing from this direction, and this is the shallower slope of the sand dune. Still looks pretty steep to me. I guess I think that this is all relatively gritty, silty size material, and therefore either they're silt dunes, I guess, rather than sand dunes, but I think that these are layers that were originally laid down flat, tipped up, and then eroded off, just like we showed in the first overhead, eroded back off to flat, and now another series of sedimentary layers, relatively very flat and probably quite fine grained. The other thing is, knowing this is taken near Rifle, Colorado, which is the old oil shale country, west of the Continental Divide. And that whole area got to become a sort of an enclosed basin. So there were mountains essentially on all sides of it. And all the streams fed into what became a very big lake. And because of the weight of the material, that lake just kept settling and kept settling and kept settling and kept settling. And it was the organic material that was both put in, and the creatures that lived in here and then died off, that make the stuff that was called kerogen, that is the stuff that's in oil shale that people try to burn. So this was in relationship to a project at a site where Occidental Petroleum was going to go in and back in the oil shale days, back in the early 80s here in the US, everybody else went in and built pilot scale plants, and Occidental went in and built a mine and spent $800 million and never got a penny out of it. So, but Armie Hammer did enough other things that he still made a lot of money. Yeah. But I think another, how many steps is that? Lay this material down flat, tip it up on, and erode it off, lay down another set of material. Four steps of geology there. Again, if we could figure out, either from the fossils that might be in here, we could come up with an age date based on work that other people had done, or by radiometric dating, we could say, okay, this is 135 million years ago, and this is 100 million years ago, so now we can put some more quantitativeness to our geologic story. Next one, please. Looks kind of the same to me as the first slide we show, as far as grain size up to bowling ball or a little bit bigger, pumpkin size right there. Relatively a lot of not matrix material, but of stuff being carried by it. Fist size and golf ball size stuff in there. I'm going back to the same idea I had before, that this is some sort of mudslide or some sort of viscous flow. Part of the reason I would tend to think that is, this is a photo that I took in Indonesia, and another thing that you need to consider when you're thinking about geology is sort of what's the climate and what's the recent geology of the area and what's the relief of the area. That in Indonesia is very young geologically. It's coming up really quickly, and so you can develop a lot of relief there. Relief is the difference in elevation between the high parts of the area and the low parts of the area. There's a lot of relief there. The rock is relatively young, and they have monsoons every year. So they get, I don't know how many inches of rain they get over there, but it's in the hundreds of inches of rain. And so I can picture in my mind very easily some soil on a steep slope with a ton of rain on top of it becoming liquid and starting to flow, and as it gets some momentum behind it, being able to pick up whatever, both carrying what's in it originally and then picking up stuff that it runs across on the way. And then I think that's why you get a picture that turns out like this.
So in a mud flow, we'd probably see the bigger rocks would be a little bit more angrier than the big rocks we find in the bottom of the stream.
Possibility. Yeah, but not.
I'm thinking of the stream bed. I might see a mix of, you know, silty stuff and bigger stuff. I'm trying to imagine how I would discern whether it was a, you know, mud flow mix of big and small, or a stream bed where there was a, you know, pocket of silt here and back eddy. And
yeah, I think if you're looking at stream beds, that there's a segregation and that there should be some variability as you would go from place to place. Again, this is a relatively small thing. And it was also in a kind of a cut channel that was up in a bank. You know, I'm down here hiking the creek, and this thing was up here like that. So, and pretty much filled it. So whether it was flowing across ground and then found a little channel to flow in and said, let's go that way, that's excellent, please.
Don't you get that from a flash flood?
Yes.
It isn't sorted, it's just everything.
Yep.
Hunks of wood, everything.
Yep.
Well, the volcano activity does the pyroclastic flows and then makes mud flows because of the heat of the... I mean, we've had that on Mount St. Helens to some extent.
Yes. I would think that for pyroclastics, you would find, first off, that interior material would be welded. The grains would be fused together by the heat. And I would think you would also find more angular stuff. I mean, at St. Helens.
But a mud flow is a result of suddenly kind of coming down and pushing the stream in Helens.
Right, okay.
To that, you know,
yeah. And well, then you would have to pick up stuff that was from the stream.
Yeah, right.
To be relatively round. Okay. All right, what am I thinking about now, Joanne? Because this is, I think, a pyroclastic rock. It's this, I had hoped this would turn out better, but this is a big rock. This is a boulder about that big around, and when you look at it on the finer detail, there are lots of different kinds of rocks inside a matrix that's all the same. And if this were a stream type rock, we would call it, or a sedimentary rock, we would call it a conglomerate, because it has all different kinds of rocks, both shapes, sizes, and types in there. In this case, it is matrix material. When you look at it with a hand lens, you can see the grains, they're fused together. And with this being Indonesia, and over the recent geologic time and being very volcanically active, this is something where a hot flow of ash came out of a volcano, and at such a speed that it picks up everything that's in the way and carries it along. And at some point when it cools enough and rips stuff out of the ground, I mean, whatever the surface that it flows across, there is so much energy and so much heat in this flow that it'll pick solid rock up out of whatever the bedrock was and carry it along. And so these grains, some of the grains in here are really angular, and again, the matrix is sort of fused together where you see the grains sort of touching one another. The boundaries aren't real sharp. It seems like one had, or they've sort of melted together. And that's a real classic example of pyroclastic breccia, is what that's called.
Are the lines on here really in the rock?
Probably not. I'll check with you. Maybe the scanner. No, that's from the scanner.
Scanner.
Yep. All right. Let's look at the bottom one here first. This is back in the oil shale country, back in Colorado. That's 60 feet. If you drive into the canyon where we're working, you can see 2,000 feet of rock like this, and none of the single layers are thicker than a couple of sheets of paper. This is oil shale country. This is that closed basin that I talked about before, and it's just amazing to go there and look and say, okay, 1,500 feet high, to think about, let's come up with an idea of how much sediment goes down into Lake Chelan on a yearly basis, like one grain width. Well, I don't know how long it takes. This stuff is, I'm not sure what the age of this stuff is, probably 100 million years old, but if we wanted to figure out how long it would take to deposit all of that material, we could do some calculation along those lines to say, let's assign that we're going to silt up a millimeter a year, and then how many millimeters does it take to make 1,500 feet, and that's the period of time. And we could try and do some fossil dating to see whether where we were in the time scale and whether our guess was good or not.